Thank you for coming. It's my pleasure to be serving as moderator this evening for this evening's panel discussion. My name is Chris McGlinchey, and I am the conservation scientist in the conservation department here at the museum. Just to give you a little bit of background, I provide technical support to the conservation department. I am not, obviously, an environmental scientist, as the theme of tonight's discussion might suggest. However, I am involved with the museum's energy task force, which is charged with identifying and prioritizing greening initiatives here at the museum. And there's also a grassroots group here at the museum that is involved with environmental stewardship issues, which I'm also involved with. And it was through that group that Agnes Bolt and myself have discussed the possibility of having some public component. And so Agnes and myself had discussions with Pablo Helguera from Adult Programming, and this is a product of that discussion. So I want to thank Agnes for this collaboration, and also thank our speakers in advance for their work. So just to give you a sense of the format, I want to keep this as open and fluid as possible. I want to encourage Raul and Fritz to have a dialogue amongst themselves. So I hope that I won't do too much speaking, but I am prepared with a list of questions that I hope to intersperse throughout the discussion. So I really want to keep this a fluid evening. And I want to couch it around the concept of thinking. I really do want to put an emphasis on thinking here. And so we tend to think of sustainability as our relationship to resources like energy and material goods and the impact consuming these things have on the earth. For example, much energy in the form of dialogue has been spent on how long fossil fuels will last. Did world oil production peak in 2005, or will it peak in 2010? Will 90% of the world's coal be gone by 2069, or will all of it be gone by the year 2010, or 2110, sorry. These are numbers that I got from a bona fide science source. Sustainable thinking is going beyond these details and visualizing a post-fossil fuel era. In terms of fuel for the human body, the food we eat is increasingly derived from a narrow set of crops, undermining the biodiversity of the planet and the nutritional value of the meals we eat. How do we move in a direction where nutrition is addressed without compromise to the planet or our bodies? Sustainable thinking, emphasis on thinking, takes these issues into account too. So from a cognitive perspective, how do we adapt? As pedestrian as it sounds, these weighty issues get traction when they are addressed at a local level. And this is precisely where both of our speakers tonight come into play. They focus their resources in this area. They each have a talent for involving others in their work and in the process challenge their work's authorship. They are also known to wear many hats. The current mode of thinking is that the most challenging problems will be solved by mashing together people from different backgrounds with different skill sets. So on multiple levels, engaging others and being adaptive, both Fritz and Raul will be able to provide insight on sustainable thinking and how it might look in future communities. So I want to first introduce Fritz. Fritz Haig works between his art, architecture, and design practice, Fritz Haig Studio, though currently preferred clients are animals. You're here. The happenings and gatherings of Sundown Salon, now Sundown Schoolhouse, the ecology initiatives of Garden Lab, including edible estates, and other various combinations of building, curating, dancing, designing, exhibiting, gardening, organizing, talking, teaching, and writing. His home base since 2001 is a geodesic dome in the hills of Los Angeles. Haig studied architecture in Italy at the Istituto Universitario di Architettura di Venezia and Carnegie Mellon University. where he received his bachelor's in architecture. He has variously taught in architecture, design, fine art programs at California Institute of the Arts, CalArts, Art Center College of Design, Parsons School of Design, and the University of Southern California. In 2006, he initiated Sundown Schoolhouse, the self-organized educational environment originally based in his geodesic home in Los Angeles. Now that he's often on the road around the U.S. and abroad for projects, exhibitions, and talks, it continues as an itinerant companion to his various projects. Haig has produced projects that were exhibited at the Tate Modern London, the Whitney Museum of American Art, SF MoMA, Casco Office of Art, Design and Theory, Utrecht, Mass MoCA, the Institute of Contemporary Art, Philadelphia, the Watts Institute, San Francisco, the Netherlands Architecture Institute, Maastricht, among others. His work has been widely publicized internationally, including features in New York Times, Financial Times, Frieze, Art Forum, The Independent, Dwell, Men's Vogue, BBC, NPR, and as of last week, Martha Stewart. So welcome, Fritz. Please give a round of applause to Fritz Haig.
Thanks so much. It's such an honor to be here and to have a conversation with Raul later. So I'll just have some brief overview of projects that have occupied me for the last couple of years. Two projects, the Edible Estates Project and Animal Estates as of last year. So this first picture is of my compost pile. And for me, this represents the highest form of human activity, which to most of us represents today in contemporary society probably the lowest form of human activity, which is down in the muck at the bottom. And the reason the compost pile is so important to a gardener and so important to me metaphorically in all the work that I'm doing is what happens when you realize that all the junk that falls to the bottom that we assign the value of zero is actually any hope of future life or fertility is there. So if we can figure out how to muck around there at the bottom and figure out how that stuff can actually go back to the top of the pile again, to me that's fascinating. And I'm looking at that as a metaphor in, I think, a lot of the work that I'm doing. So very quickly, to quickly go over some thoughts that have led up to the Edible Estates Project, this is a painting by Albert Bierstadt representing this fantasy idea of manifest destiny, this fantastic world that we received as Americans when we took over this continent. And I love this painting for what it represents of this fantasy of infinite resources. And having moved to LA 10 years ago, there is this kind of phenomenal sense of arrival you have of coming from New York and reaching that edge at the Pacific and realizing that's our kind of physical limit on this continent, this idea of westward movement. So here's the fantasy, this idealized fantasy, and here's the reality, the same location, the people that were living there. And for a lot of these European, these early European settlers who saw these people living there, they were thinking, oh, look at the lazy natives doing nothing, living high off this amazing landscape, when in fact what they were entering into was a highly tended garden. There's a wonderful book called Tending the Wild that comes out of about 15 years of research. I'm forgetting the author's name, but it talks very specifically about how the people that were living there gardened this supposedly wild landscape, harvesting very strategically, burning strategically, straightening cane in the rivers to make baskets. So what they were seeing was not a wild landscape, but really a garden. And it's easy to romanticize that, but I am in all of my work kind of trying to return to some highly integrated life in which your relationship to the land is that connected. So here's where these Europeans are coming from, I suppose. The English estate, which is where we see the first front lawns, the landscape pushed way down, tended into a frame for this massive house, the productive vegetable garden hidden from view. So here's this disconnect between pleasure and production. And what I've come to realize in the last few months in my work is it really is more and more about pleasure than anything else. And by finding that pleasure again, it takes you back into a place of integration, as opposed to work about responsibility, which is so boring. And actually, I don't think I wake up any morning with the sense of responsibility of my work at all. And I think that's a common misperception among people that make work like this. That's about saving the world. For me, the work every day is more about pleasure and just going towards where the pleasure is for myself. And it happens to be animals and gardens, you know? So that's what I've been gravitating towards. Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, the great icon of the American dream. Again, the garden hidden from view, a grid down the hill behind trees producing food, and yet in front of the house, the pleasure landscape is all curvy lines and lawns. Then during the war, we've got victory gardens. We've got Americans out in front of their houses in a crisis mode growing food, 80% of Americans growing some of their food here. And then after the war, that dried up immediately, and we have Le Corbusier's beautiful dream. If you can read that, I'm not going to read it, but it's breathtaking. Quote by Le Corbusier, where you realize the world that we're living in has been totally planned and engineered. This was not a mistake where we're at now. Part of me thinks that if I was alive at that time, I would be the hardest core modernist ever and right there with him. And I think it's all about balance. And when something's out of balance and the world is too wild, you tend towards control. And when we're in too much control, you come in and you want to do something wild. And I think the only reason my work is now looking for moments of wildness to reintroduce, it's because the balance is off. So it's not about this strategy is always wrong or the strategy of integrating wild gardens into cities is always right. It has to do with, I think, being hyper-responsive to the moment that we're in and recognizing what needs to be there. So anyway, he was never able to make his great radiant cities, and yet you realize when you read this that we're all living in radiant cities. The whole world is the radiant city now, this hyper-isolation between each activity. Here's Lakewood, California, city of 70,000 built in 3 years at the end of the 40s. This is where I did the second edible estates garden. And here's the American dream that we're exporting globally now. And to me, the big story of all of this is hyper-isolation on every level. If you're familiar with the Eames video, Powers of 10, where you can see the cellular structure of the body and then go out to the planetary structure, it's the same thing with the world we're living in today, where isolation happens within the home as we chopped up rooms and further apart, and it happens on the scale of just food coming from the other side of the planet. So we've divided very successfully everything. And a lot of my work is involved with how to strategically weave some of those things back together. Or in some cases, I almost think of it as urban acupuncture, where I'm going in and looking for pressure points in society and then very narrowly focused ones and then pushing really hard. Like, what happens if you grow food here? And that's a moment where some sort of repercussions will happen and then observing them. Okay, so I'm fascinated with these pictures because they represent our ideal of what we want, and it's this illusion of independence. It's all about this fantasy of independence, and it's actually quite the opposite. So if you look at all these pictures, you'll never see another house. You'll see the wilderness at bay protected by this moat of the lawn, when in fact this is the most dependent situation probably any human has ever experienced. If systems in and out of this thing shut down tomorrow, these people are so screwed. But the fantasy of the picture is independence. Like, I'm alone, nobody else lives around me, I dominate this landscape, I'm in control. But these are not English estate owners with servants growing the food out back. These are people dependent on people in China producing their electronics and people in New Zealand producing their apples. And when those systems shut down, they have no idea what to do. So as I began the Edible Estates Project in 2004, I began to look at the space of the front lawn. Beautiful here. This could be a lawn, not quite a lawn ad, but that was LA. This is New Jersey. So what does that mean when we've created this industrial landscape that can be the same anywhere on the planet, but also this space that epitomizes the American dream, really? How much time and extra resources do you need to be able to maintain a space like this that has no function? Dumping chemicals and water and polluting with lawnmowers and stuff in the most strategically strategic location in our cities with the most potential to make some impact, the most visible place right in front of the house between the private front door and the public street. So anyway, this is a space that, you know, we've got like 30 million acres of lawn in the United States. Like, here's a moment where we could think about repurposing land that we've already claimed and think about the potential that exists there. So here's a new house in New Jersey. Here's a few hundred years ago. It's like, what? What happened? There's, what sort of progress happened here? So the Edible Estates Project started in 2004, and design and plays a huge role in this, in names too. I really wanted to give it a name to legitimize it, to take some previously radical anarchist hippie activity and rebrand it for a contemporary suburban Midwestern audience, which is where I'm from, suburban Minneapolis. So, and I grew up with the front lawn, and I wanted to make this project for my aunt in New Jersey and for my grandma, and a project that could equally speak very clearly to the typical American homeowner. So the original intention of the project was to divide the country into 9 squares and do 1 garden in each square that would be a regional prototype garden to show what would be possible, removing an entire front lawn, replacing it entirely with an edible landscape, working with 1 family in each city that would already be an avid gardener in that region, and we'd plant the garden, and then I'd leave, and then it's their garden, it's not my garden, and they take over. So each garden is commissioned by a museum or art institution, and then the garden is actually 1 small part of the project. The larger part of the project is telling the story of it. So it'll be producing videos and brochures and exhibitions and reading libraries and workshops and the website and the book, which came out last year. So it's like taking this one little modest garden and then broadcasting the hell out of it and making its story like a parable or something. And most people have never seen the gardens. They only experience them secondhand. And I really want to work with homeowners who are really articulate spokespeople who can tell their story. So here's the first garden, Salina, Kansas. This was after 3 years now, so it's grown in. And the first planting always has every single plant I can find that will produce food in that region, so that over time they can figure out what works and what doesn't. This is probably one of the most wild ones, which strawberries around the perimeter. It's being covered by grapevines now. The second family in Lakewood, you saw the picture of Lakewood, New Jersey. So this was a dream to find this family in Lakewood that is up for this, because my dream is to do it really in a place where it's illegal, like a housing community or development where they have a covenant where you can't do this, and then you go to, like, housing development jail or wherever they take you if you do this. But it's really extreme there, these sorts of limits on what you can do in front of your house. But the type of people that tend to live there want that kind of predictability in their landscape. So it was very... I was really thrilled to find a family that lives in someplace like Lakewood that's up to this. They had an organic garden in their backyard at this time, and hens, and a website charting the production of their eggs, so I knew that these are people who were up for this. And their kids, like, originally got him into gardening. So this was after the end of the summer. This was Maplewood, New Jersey, a recently transplanted couple from the East Village with some tattoos, so they were psyched to... piss off their neighbors. The house on the left is actually elderly German immigrants who were thrilled when we did the garden. And the house on the right, they were really upset. So it's interesting to see these two opposite reactions on either side of the house. So volunteers making the garden. This is after, like, towards the end of the summer. This is London. This is more of a communal garden. I wanted to design something that could be uniquely appreciated from above by the residents of the council housing estates that would be tending it. It's not a community or allotment garden, but it's a communal garden that people eat from and tend from communally. So this is right in the middle of London, one of the least green parts of Southwark, just south of Tate Modern, who commissioned it. And again, this is permanent, so I was just back a couple months ago, and it's interesting to check up and see how it's doing. And, you know, now some other council estates in the area are asking for a similar garden. This is an apartment complex in Austin. Again, the thing that never surprises me now is it's always the kids who are there on board first, least suspicious, least skeptical. The adults are always like, oh, I don't know if this garden's going to work here. It's awfully public. Or people are going to steal our zucchinis. And the kids are always like, yeah, let's do it. What? They don't ask those kind of boring questions. And then this was Austin. We have a schoolhouse, a mobile schoolhouse that travels to every city where there's workshops and bulletin board displays and plants growing in the window. This was called How to Eat Austin. So every week you could come and go from compost week 1 to cooking on week 8. So this kind of broad network of activity associated with the garden. This was the most recent one in Baltimore, Maryland, the Ridgelys. Clarence has become quite a Baltimore celebrity on his street. And actually, this garden is way too big for him, so his neighbors have started to grow some of their food there now, too. So in a way, it's become a community garden in and of itself. And I really want to work. The whole point is to do this in places where it's least likely to happen, on streets where no one else would have the guts to do this on their own. But the legitimacy that the name and the project brings can, you know, make it happen in places that otherwise wouldn't. So I wouldn't do this like on some hippie street in Portland. Like, the whole point is to do it in a place where it's going to, there's going to be a shock to the system in some way. And then the book, which came out last year, which is part of the storytelling, the whole first season of the blog that the homeowner from Lakewood kept is in here, and stories by each one of the homeowners and other essays. And then finally, I'll just wrap up by quickly showing you a few images of the Animal Estates Project, which started last year. This is the next garden. So we're planting this in June. This June, the next garden will be in Manhattan at the corner of 26th and 10th Avenue. And for the Animal Estates Project, I started working with Eric Sanderson, a wonderful landscape ecologist who does the Manhattan Project, who's been doing deep research into the natural history of the island, finding out what did this island look like 2 p.m. or something, September 10, 1609, when Henry Hudson came up the river and set first European foot on soil here. So here's the two pictures, before and after. This is the picture that Eric Sanderson generated. Here's the sort of garden we're going to be planting, which is the sort of landscape that the Lenape people would have eaten from 400 years ago. So it'll be like a little time warp garden. Three sisters, corn, squash, beans, little wigwam. And here's the site, which is in front of the Hudson Guild Community Center, a triangular piece of land. So if any of you are around the weekend of June 13th and you want to help out, we'll be planting that weekend. And then it'll be, you know, hopefully a permanent addition to that place. And it won't be, it'll be more of like a stage that you're looking into. It's not meant to be a landscape you go into, but something you look at and watch change through the seasons. And finally, Animal Estates, really quickly. Not livestock you grow in your front yard to then slaughter and eat, as some of my friends mistook it for when I first told them about Animal Estates. But it's this basic thought of, do we want animals in our cities? If so, which ones? And how can we make them welcome. So it's almost like, I think about it as an architecture project where we consider a very modest layer of architecture grafted onto our cities that's made specifically for native animals that we want there. But again, like the other projects, there's a lot of other activities associated with it. So it was in 7 cities last year, the most recent one in Portland, Oregon. This is a snag, which is a dead tree, which is where a lot of animals in the Pacific Northwest live. So it was designing an architectural snag that could be built throughout the city, and then some propaganda spread around town to encourage Portlanders to design their own snag. Utrecht, butterfly feeding station, high-tech animal estate, the compost pile for the snake. I'll go through these quickly. In San Francisco, is more about weekly activities, so we had some animal experts come in locally, and then kids make the slender salamander estate, which is just a board of wood that you throw on the ground. And I love having this range of animal estates that are very sophisticated, original designs, which I think, coming from an architecture background, is what is privileged. Like in an architecture education, it's all about your original thought and making your mark and developing something that's never been seen before. And I think in my original conception of animal estates, that was my idea. I would go around being the genius animal architect, making new designs like that Portland tower you saw. But I'm becoming more and more drawn to the butterfly feeding stations and the salamander estates and saying, like, no, this is awesome. Like, this is brilliant high-tech architecture. You know, how are we going to do this? Like, boards on the ground and really strategic compost piles. And I've become more and more drawn to those sorts of activities. This is the Animal Estates headquarters, which travels from city to city. And finally, last thing, really quickly, the first Animal Estate, shout out to Kim, who's in the audience, who helped produce this at the Whitney, who's now at MoMA, who helped us make this crazy beaver dam there. But so Eric Sanderson, again, did this picture of Manhattan, picture of Manhattan 400 years ago, 75th and Madison. selecting 12 animals that used to live at the corner of 75th and Madison 400 years ago that I would now make homes for in front of the museum where they used to live, now the Whitney. So here was this landscape of animal homes that could be viewed on one hand as utopian, let's bring the animals back, isn't this awesome and cool, or tragic and just depressing and devastating and apocalyptic. Like, is this what we've come to? So there's the beaver dam, the eagle's nest, the beaver pond, the animal estates model home flags, because these were considered model homes that anyone could build over the weekend at home. And then finally, we had, I was working with dancers that developed a score of movement inspired by each one of the animals that were performed through the museum every week. That was the goal, at the strata at which those animals used to live. So moving from the eagle on the top floor to the turtles here in the bookstore at the bottom floor. I think I will end there with my compost pile. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Fritz. And next, Raul Cardenas Osuna is architect and artist and the founding member of the Collective Toro Lab, a Tijuana-based consortium of artists, designers, and musicians. It was founded in 1995 as a socially engaged laboratory committed to examining and elevating the quality of life for residents of Tijuana and for the trans-border region through a culture of ideologically advanced design. Their work encompasses fine art, architecture, clothing, music, and graphic design. In 2006, Toro Lab began a series of projects under the umbrella name Molecular Urbanism, in which the collective set out to investigate ways to visualize the complex and constantly shifting interrelationship between the human body, urban architectural fabric, and local climate. For example, in COMA, 2006-2007, Toro Lab traced the physiological changes of a Mexican person in their everyday relation to food. The collective's project culminated in creating a new food product, a type of bread containing all absent nutrients in a typical Mexican diet. According to the Mexican National National Health Census, for the project, Toro Lab collaborated with local gastronomy students, musicians, and artists. Toro Lab's recent exhibitions and projects have been featured at SF MoMA, the University of South Florida Contemporary Art Museum, the Museum of Craft and Folk Art, San Francisco, Galleria OMR in Mexico City, the Storefront for Art and Architecture in New York City, the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego, the Liverpool Biennial of Contemporary Art, among many more. Raul, thank you so much.
Such a tough act to follow, guys. Well, let me see over here. All right. So, well, let me tell you a little bit about the Toro Lab really briefly. Well, basically, the Toro Lab is a loose-based collective in which we basically what we do is contextual studies. We focus a lot in the idea of quality of life and what people think it is quality of life from them. So when you think about it, it's only an idea, right? So the projects tend to change according to the context that we're working in. And not all the projects have to do about transborder region. They have to do about all these different contexts. And according to the context, we have teams put together that work for such projects. And we go from doing, from food to gardens to music to auto-construction system. Oh, my God. Oh, Jesus. Okay, there you go. In 1995, we started with two projects, one called Toro Vestimenta, and another one that I'm going to tell you briefly because it will lead you to the ideas of molecular urbanism and COMA, which is emergency architecture. And we started doing our own processes of contextual analysis, and we started to follow, for example, lines of consumption of material that people recuperated to do their own homes. Because I don't know if you know this, but in all Latin American cities, and that's not and it's worse in other continents, but 70% of the cities is not done by architects or urbanists, but actually is done by the necessity of the people. So when you have this beautiful macro planning and you go to your streets and stuff, well, the streets are pretty much there. Right? And people have to adapt. And places like Tijuana are so hard to read. So we have to adapt and do certain projects that allow us to have a different perspective, a different portrait of what these places could be. In this case, something that we showed here with Paola Antonelli, which is, the region of the transborder trousers. I'll tell you really briefly what it is. But you see, the transborder trousers are some very simple jeans like the ones I'm wearing right here. Right? And it just have two pockets in the front and one in the back. But if you put it on and you're a resident of Tijuana, you immediately realize that it has hidden pockets. Right? And you say, oh, well, from my passport, from my laser visa, from my cell phone, etc. If you are a resident of San Diego, well, you don't have a recognition of the proportion through the use because you don't need a passport to cross to Mexico, right? You don't need a laser visa. You don't even know what one is. You know what a credit card Visa is, and not a debit one like us. And the cell phone is used for very different reasons, right? It's not because you have one of the toughest telephone bills in the world, but because of mobility, right? And we started to follow the life of five persons through 5 days of their lives. And that led us to the construction of an auto construction system that I won't have time to go really deeply into it, but it's made for this region, and it's out of construction, and it's from used pallets, used garage doors from San Diego, and used tires that we use as gardens, contention walls, and steps. And we follow the life of certain people. And this person right here is Carmen Duran Ponce, which she allowed us to help to facilitate for her to design her own home. And I think her home could be in any architectural magazine I can think of. You see the top part is the garage doors and everything. This is the pallets, the tires. Everything is heels over there. The front opening, it really opens with used garage remote controls and stuff. But if we really did this house in the neighborhood that she lived, and we only did that, I mean, you have to understand the context of this place. I mean, how can I tell you? I mean, a bunch of people right here have gone to San Diego and probably to Tijuana, but if you cross the border from San Diego to Tijuana, you don't travel to Tijuana, you're there. Right? And basically the things that happen in these conditions are so extreme through contrast, right, that if you go to these neighborhoods, it really doesn't make sense if you come from San Diego because I mean you don't have running water, no electricity, no sewage, and there is no pavement. I mean, I've seen dead people in the ground, and that's for true, and I mean, dead dogs electrocuted from the when they're stealing electricity. It's very different when you have a perspective from the other side and when you live there and you work there. But for example, the neighbor from Carmen, I mean, he has a what we call a crystal house that in the 90s used to be a crack house. Now it's a very more sophisticated drug that they use rat poison and stuff to build. And it's the same age of their kids who actually, consume that stuff. So if we don't do something about the complete environment where she lives, we'll be doing her, in the short run, some benefit. But in the long run, you have to change the environment. So she became a Toro Lab member, right? And her job was to find other 9 families that she wanted to share her life with, that she wanted her kids to grow up with. And now we had to develop a system in which these families relate to each other, right? Because some of them didn't know Carmen is the node, right? And then start building systems, social systems that relate to the architecture. So the architectural design is just a pretext to start making this thing. Like, for example, from these 9 families, 8 of them are single mothers, right? For example, the life of Carmen. She goes to work at 7 o'clock at night, goes home at 7 o'clock in the morning, comes back, takes her kids to school, works at school, takes them home, right? And then she cooks for them, make them do their homework, falls to sleep for three, four hours, then go back to work. But what happens if now one of these women who's in the neighborhood, takes care of the kids of the other ones, right? What do you do with 6 free days off? Do you have a boyfriend? Do you study something else? Right? So, well, and that led us to the idea of something that you guys work a lot much better in your English language, which is the word nourishment, right? And the ideas of how you nourish your home and how you nourish the basically your friends and you nourish your family and then how you nourish yourself in your physicality. And we tried as much as we could to start to do a project about the food access, right? And systems of production, distribution, and value of food. And thanks to one very intimidating artist, his name is Thomas Hishorn, we got invited to work in Italy from all places, and we started to work in this map that became a new food product from a very distinctive region of Italy that is more German, actually, than Italian, that is called Bolzano, and we developed a new food product, which is a new type of pasta called Lagrinetti, made from a wine of the denomination of that year, that area, but if you take it apart, right, and all the ingredients tell you all the ethnographical layout of this place through their ingredients. Now, when we tried to bring it to Mexico, it became very different because, I mean, it doesn't make sense. If you talk about Italy, right, you talk about good wines and good food, no, and slow food. It's the third of their economy. Right? Food access to those things becomes something else. For us, food access is completely different. So when we translated this product, we have to do a project of auto-destruction, right? We have to do something that had to do more with, how could I tell you? Yeah. Auto-plagiarism and pirating, and we basically did this product with products from Mexico and between Aguascalientes and Tijuana and Puebla instead of the Lombardía and Bolzano, and basically at the end what we have over here is a project in which we with the engineers that we work of the food engineering PhD department of University of Las Americas, we have this clock that tells you the days, hours, minutes, and seconds that this thing would take until it starts to rot and become dust. And it's very strong to see such a thing that has such a finite time and so precisely. But that finally led us to Mexico in a city called Puebla. Puebla, very briefly, Puebla is the first place where the Mexican food combined with the Spanish food. Right? And if you think of something like mole, you don't think of the black mole of Oaxaca or the green one of Tlaxcala, you think of mole poblano. And the three most important gastronomy schools are in Puebla. And basically, people, for example, from the that do market research for McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Frito-Lay, even Chili's, and Bimbo, which is a monopoly of bread in Mexico, when they try a new food product for Mexico, they try it in Puebla. And according to the project, and I know marketing is not exact science, but we decide to believe them, it gives you a range from 60% to, I don't know, 70-some percent according to the product that it will work for the rest of Mexico. So if we wanted to do a mapping project like the one I showed you of the transborder pants, right? And you want to do this portrait about how we, because like he said right now, Chris, just briefly, this work has to do with molecular urbanism. But what is molecular urbanism? Well, molecular urbanism is really small intervention and changes into the human body that somehow make programmatic changes in your life. Let's say you're going fatter or thinner, your hair is growing or falling, you're sweating more. Anything that changes the program of your life. When that happens, you change the immediate relation that you have to your space, right? When that happens to other persons, you change urban environments. So we decided to go to two venues. One of them being, yes, the physiognomical changes in the Mexican personas with their everyday relationship with food, and then how the city changes because of the first thing. The other one, constructed spaces against green spaces, and the race of temperature and the race of temperament and moods, right? And this first one, we wanted to do, you know, just a mapping, a portrait of how we have changed and the cities have changed. But when we gather all the information, we found out some very interesting stuff. I mean, Mexico is the second fattest nation, at least in this continent, right? And you guys are the first. And And also, not only that, but 40% of the debt of our nation come from what you ingest, right? And I mean, we're talking about a country that only last year had more violent deaths than all the Iraq war put together, right? And 30% of the people who are fat, which is 7 out of 10, right, their health is in risk, right? And things like diabetes mellitus that even a little kid can get, the National Census of Health calls it an epidemic. Epidemic used to be viral, not behavioral. Right, but the most shocking thing for us was that, we're a nation of malnourished people, just like when I was a little kid. So we're fat, malnourished Mexican people, and when we started to do that map turned into this thing that people started to call the picudita, because it means, I don't know, the sharpie or the pointy or something like that. And it also means cool in that area of Mexico. And basically, we wanted to do a hybrid between a tortilla and a bread, but technically it's a bread. And it's a hybrid between a complete meal and something you accompany a meal with. And if you eat it, yes, you have all the missing elements of the Mexican diet, according to the last census, in terms of vitamin A, B6, C, D, E, ferrum, iron, and calcium. The only one missing is B12, but that comes more in animal protein, and then you add it with a little cheese or with meat or something. This is one that I particularly like, but I'm a carnivore. It has carne asada and mushrooms and avocado and string cheese of Oaxaca and an emulsion of chile cuaresmeño and lemon, but they're, vegetarians too. And we did our own thing, you know, with the nutritional factors and stuff. But then we send the dough and the bread to the laboratories of our friend in the PhD department, and they send us back these numbers and a lot more, and we were so happy because we felt like the Mayans with the calendar. We were so close to the darn thing. But then we had the problem of how to distribute it in the city. This is the last sketch and what we built, and this is a moving oven that is collapsible. So there is a sensory attraction to this thing because this is an organoleptic design. And this is the thing that sucks about our project. They take too long to develop. And we took only 4 months for the taste of the product because we knew the missing element. We knew the organic element that hold them, right? But now we had to have, you know, the exact arrangement so it was an organoleptic, so it tasted good. But not only tasted good, what's in good terms with the other senses. It smelled good. It felt good. It somehow looked good, at least for the Mexican palate. And then we did a new collective called Coma. And Coma were these kids from gastronomy school, architectural school, visual arts school, and musical school who had this performatic aspect about them, who will approach you to give you this product, right? Because the other thing is not only what you eat, it's how you eat it, right? I know it's not enough for serious scientists, but we timed 300 persons, right? And when they gave them their tortas or three tacos or burger or hot dog, it take them from 8 to 10 minutes on average to consume. And it takes from 12 to 14 minutes, if you're the size of Fritz, to have information from your belly to your brain that there is something there. Time enough to make a disaster. It's not only about rates of metabolism, it's about nutrition absorption. So these guys had the job of making you, lose 6 minutes of your life while eating, right? And it seemed like bad business, but it wasn't. They came back. And it was an heterogeneous design, which means that more people, from people who shine your shoes to people who, the governor of the state went to eat there, right? And this was part of the ad campaign. We had all these wonderful, gigantic stickers that we will add to the delivery trucks of Coca-Cola and McDonald's and stuff. And basically, every time that we put this thing out, it sold out. No, every time. I mean, it's not like we brought a bunch of it, but we sold out every time. So in fact, the first persons who called us, because this is supposed to be not about art traditions, but art franchises, more or less, right? And the first persons to call us about the art franchises were the people who do the marketing research for McDonald's and Coca-Cola and Frito-Lay. And that takes us to this other part about the relation of constructed spaces, green spaces, right? A race of temperature and a race of moods. And then we go to Culiacán, Mexico. Sinaloa is the state that is more complicated in a complicated country, right? And you tell me with the time when I stop. But basically, there is this botanical garden over there. And they want to do something about the image of this place. So they hire this super incredible curator and decides to invite 25 great artists, 24 really good, and then me, right? And then they invite me to go there to intervene the botanical garden with a permanent addition, right? And they give me this walkman, and I walk and see about the ficus and the palms, and they tell me, choose a place where you want to work. And I find this place where they have, you know, bamboo and bonsais and stuff. I say, I want to work here. And they tell me, you know what, I'm sorry, but Mr. Gabriel Orozco hasn't confirmed, but really like this spot. Okay, cool. How about that corner? Oh, you see, Mr. Olafur Eliasson really has that thing going for him. How about that other one? No, Valesca Suarez. How about here? Well, right there and everywhere around it is Mr. James Sorrell. And there, well, Mr. Dan Graven, well, where the freaking God you want me to work? and then it was, they took 2 days, the curator came and said, no, we're going to give you the best spot possible. But basically, you know, I felt like in Space Mountain, have you seen the ever-shrinking man, you know, who becomes particles, you know, and disappears? But, well, basically what happens is that I love the idea of not having a territory to work on. It's like it's like my life, right? And I became friends from the biologists and ecologists who work in the botanical garden, which a lost opportunity right there. They eat in front of the university, and they do nothing, right? They used to give tours, but now they have the headphone things. So I told them, "Would you like to be part of Toro?" They say, "Yeah." So I went to the municipal government, to the urban design, and told them about the idea, and the idea is this. I bought a bimbo truck, changed the diesel thing into biogas. I'm constructing this thing that you see over here. And I'm doing a moving lab. And half of it, it does, biological and ecological studies. And the second back part is, well, it's a garden truck. And with the municipal government, now we find empty lots in the city, right? And in all these empty voids, we start inserting the botanical garden. So the botanical garden now is integrated to the urban fabric and becomes part of it and it grows. No, and the more we do it, the botanical garden gets bigger. But then we go with the correct design in them, with these people in biology and ecology, with the right specimen and the site of the roots and stuff. In time, we go from microclimates to microclimates, right? So we will come to a point that there will be lower in temperature. I mean, and we're talking about a place that normally goes 40 degrees Celsius almost every day of the year. Right, and people collapse after 42 degrees, right? And I mean, and like Spike Lee said, funny things happen in the hottest days of the year, right? So I'm going to show you, just to finish really briefly, some images of experiments that we have been doing with gardening and hydroponics and other urban layouts that we've been working on, in which we do these interventions in the city. And now the biggest one that we're doing, which isn't just moving a mangrove. And this a municipal government is working with us, and we went to the federal government, and we start building it this year. And just the first stage of the project, you know, it's over 54 acres, just the first stage, and then it grows 10 times more, right? And right now we're working in Oakland with some urban farm from a very specific Oriental ethnicity, which is the Yumien people, who at some point made, in my opinion, the mistake of helping the United States government in the Vietnam War, specifically to the CIA, and then they were put in refugee camps, and in the 80s, they went back for a lot of them and came back, but the integration to the American society has been very tough. Their language is very unique. If they're bilingual, they learn Chinese, and it's hard for them. So it's about oral traditions. It's about their cooking. And it's about what we're planting over there, which is just, you know, vegetables and fruit that they cannot get over here. No, that it has to do with their traditions. So we go from tradition to transition to translation. And I think I'm going to finish with this thing over here. And I know it was a tough act to follow, and Well, there you go.
Collaboration process, it seems quite radical.
Yeah, actually, I have a quick question for him first that came up to me as we were watching those, because something really struck me, and it's been something I've been thinking about in my work so much, and I don't even know quite how to put it, except to say that I come from some very comfortable suburbs in the Midwest, in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And you're from Tijuana.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And we're kind of supposedly doing similar things, but I see so clearly evident in our work where we're coming from in some way, and I'm wondering how you feel about that, because there's something so... I feel like I'm coming from a place of comfort and excess in a way and responding to that, and you're coming from this very different condition, and we're... I don't know, I feel like we're coming from opposite places.
I know what you're getting, I think you let me know, but... all of these contexts have their problematics. I mean, you're talking about your context in which it's just a context that have layers upon layers of infrastructure and history, no? And then infrastructure and then history. And it's hard to work under those conditions, especially if you're engaging into politics and engagement into public realm and things to happen, because you have to have certain consensus. And that's a big problematic. Even though when you find out that in a place like that, that has such conditions of infrastructure, it's so well built and stuff, has a mistake, you may think it's easier to do something, but it's not. I mean, you have to go through all these policies, to all these convinces. I think you said it, no? It would be great to, you know, like, I don't know if you saw when the X-Files visited San Diego. right? That they went to this perfect East Lake suburb. And they went there because it was so perfect that something wrong has to be there, right? And yeah, they found this trash golem or something, right? And it's the thing. I mean, there is something wrong. And yes, the process of convincing, which is the question that I wanted to give you about the process of dialogue in your project. But first, and with me, I've had the opportunity to work in places like Liverpool or Italy, and then in Mexico, of course. And then you go into a place where you don't have basic infrastructure. So it's very close to the ideas of survival, right? Mm-hmm. To those things that are so innate in you. And trust me, there comes a time in which you're in this place and you feel tired. And even if you just cross the border, and even if you're doing work that relate to this place, it's very valid. And it's very good, but it's very different, because it romanticizes other aspects of the work, right, and of the place. And for us, it's about transformation of this environment into things that are, well, about survival.
Well, and it came up right away with the first image you showed. It was about urgency and crisis and response to an imminent issue or problem. That's very much about survival.
And even the food thing. I mean, what happens if you eat more of this thing? And let me tell you something, for just to speak good about the American situation, the United States, I'm sorry. I mean, if there was no McDonald's in Mexico, we'll still be overweight. No, really. The thing is that this process happened after Second World War, right? You know, with this thing about how to... maintain food, right, and then access to quick food. But then came, you know, there's certainly good guys in the Radiant City, but the idea of modernism and the modern city that works for places that have other type of infrastructure. But what happened when you go to a place like Tijuana, where you have more cars than persons, and the new streets are made not even have sidewalks, right? They have bridges to cross. And you're screwed if you want to walk it, because there is no public transportation. And you cannot bike it even if you're Lance Armstrong, because, well, You basically they have all these topographical accidents, no, all these hills, and the way that you perceive the cities by going 60 kilometers per hour, no, 120 centimeters above the ground, seeing images from 0 to 70 degrees every 3 seconds, right? So all this situation that goes on in a place like this, well. How could I tell you? Yeah.
Well, something that strikes me is I feel like for the most part I'm working in areas where people are actually doing okay, or they seem to be, or they think they are. There's comfort. There's maybe even an excess of goods. I mean, there was a council estate in London. Still, they're doing okay. The apartment complex in Austin, they're able to feed themselves, but here's a different situation that's presenting itself. So, I mean, for the most part, I feel like I'm revealing something beneath the system that people are in that they're not aware of. And whereas you're dealing with something that's right on the surface that everybody's quite aware of and responding to it in a more overt way. So do you know what I mean? Like I feel like there's a level of immediacy to the problem solving you're doing that.
Because you know what? Systematically, people already do that. You know, when we started working with the auto-construction system, people were already using pallets and using garage doors and the tires, right? We just did it in a way, that it works better. It's auto-construction, and they don't have to be praying to God that when it rains, their house is there and their kids are not in a landslide of mud, right? So it's taking those and just being aware of these conditions, you know, But in your case, I mean, when you work with all these neighborhoods and you have all these policies going for them, how do you deal with not only those policies, but with the dialogue that you have to establish, and how important is the dialogue in your work?
Yeah. Well, I can give one anecdote, and it probably gets at what you were starting to talk about, too. Well, first of all, there's me going someplace that I've, in some cases, never been, certainly never gardened, don't know anyone there, and I'm showing up and I'm going to, like, do some public project or drop in from nowhere and do these things. So one wonderful anecdote was when I was doing the project in London and we were kind of scoping out that piece of land, working with a local nonprofit, knocked on all 24 doors at that council estate, and I postered everywhere to have meetings. You know, we're thinking about doing this garden. Let's talk about it. So everyone would know, and whoever wanted to be involved could be. Knocked on every door of the 24 doors. Only one woman, Denise, freaked out and was like, "Oh my God, I've been waiting for you guys to show up." And she's like the key lady at the garden now. And another guy at another door was like, "We don't need a garden. We need more parking. Can we just make it a parking lot or something?" But the best part was when we were scoping out this piece of land, I'm walking around. Everyone knows what's going on. They see the obvious foreigner looking around in this vacant piece of land. That's their only green spot. And this woman who lived in another council estate came marching up to me screaming, like, "Who are you? What are you doing here? I heard you're going to tear down our trees and ruin our only green space." And you know, I started to talk her down. It's like, no, we're doing this garden together, and it's going to be just one part of this area, and it's going to be an edible garden. We can, you know, if you want to be a part of it. And then she's like, "Where are you from?" with that accent. Like, who are you? Like, you know, this American accent, like from LA, like showing up here. It's like, "Well, I'm from Los Angeles." And she's like, "What are you doing?" You know, it's just like this. The Tate sponsored it, but that's not the point, and that's not something that is supposed to be. To me, these projects are almost like using the art world as a staging ground to deliver these things into the world. We don't need to know their art projects. So for her, I'm just a stranger from LA showing up to ruin her green space. Anyway, I talked her down, and she's fine now. She's a painter, and it turns out she loves the garden, and now she's doing a painting of it. And if you watch the Edible Estates video online, you can see her. She's awesome. But that was a wonderful moment of showing at once the possibility and also the ridiculousness of the situation. But I'm also working with local will. The project can only exist if there's local will for this to happen. If there isn't, then it's not going to happen. But it's like taking whatever forces and goodwill there is that exists and kind of putting them together and then disappearing, and then it's theirs. And you know what I mean?
Well, how much importance is authorship in your projects, and to both of you?
Well, for me, I identify a very narrow bit of the project that I hold on very tightly, and the rest I can let go. So I'm very strategic about what I actually need control of, and if I hold on too tightly to the rest, there's no room for anyone else to get in. So the important part is to be very clear about what I need to hold on to no matter what, and what is free to be affected by the will of everyone else involved in it. And the projects are very, if we're going to grow food here and make places for animals there, the thought is simple and direct enough. And if the people involved are on board with that simple thought, then whatever grows out of that, I'm interested in. And really, the project is more about a proposition, and whatever the response is to that proposition is valid and interesting to me. So, and also then there's the heavy naming and designing of the projects that I think hopefully separate it from my identity, so that it's not, okay, like if I'm having a show, I'm not having a show. My project's having a show. So it's an Edible Estate show. It's not a me show. And I think that's an important distinction, and it's something that is, I think, a real shift in the way artists or cultural producers or whatever, content providers, whatever, like Laurie Anderson calls them, whatever you want to call them, I think it's an important shift away from hopefully the cult of the personality towards the predominance of a thought or idea that people can collectively go towards and be a part of, I guess.
No, I agree. I mean, in the case of Torula, well, I think it's just another type of authorship, right? Because it's a very loose-based collective, right? For example, like in the one in Puebla, there were like 20 people involved in Torula. And then we had to do a second collective. And that happens with every other single project. And there is a difference between somebody that you're working and giving you a service, that somebody who engages in the project and wants to be part of it. And for that project, in that context, in that place, according to the resources, and resources not only in terms of money, but time and knowledge and even geography, right? Well, you're part of that Toro Lab team. And we sort of put a T-shirt together of the team and chair it for that project in that place, right? And if something goes there, we share it. If something bad, it's only my fault. But sadly, yeah. And the thing is that, well, somehow that's, yeah, it's not Raúl Cárdenas and, but Toro Lab collaborating with this, and yeah.
Do people get frustrated with that? Do they want to know, like, who is this? Who's doing this project? Do people always ask that?
Yeah, there's some people who call me Toro Lab. You know, like in the first
like
person.
Like that's your name?
Yeah. And it's kind of cool sometimes, but it sounds weird. No, but yeah, it's just another type of authorship.
But do you find that it frustrates people sometimes because they want to attach a name or a person to something, and it makes them uncomfortable that it's there's this wall of between the you as a person and the project? Or does that ever get in the way or become a confusing to people?
Well, there was this magnificent research guy from the Department of Aesthetics of the National University, Mr. Francisco Reyes Palma, who was interviewing me in Colombia, and he told me that, well, you should put a name to the thing you do, right? Because we've been talking about the projects of Toro Lab for, you know, in the department for a bit now, and we're arguing if we're going to put you in a collective or not or what. So you better tag yourself or we're going to do it for you, right? And I think it's more a concern of the institutions to put those tags because it's more comfortable that way. But in a way, these projects tend to be in between, I don't know, those little gaps that are, I don't know, in between economical transactions, social interactions, no policies, and cultural exchange, mm-hmm. right? And they're left there, but that's a fluid territory that is very valid to intervene. And then you have to adapt to those things, and sometimes it doesn't fit in a gallery space, right? It's more in the urban realm. But that's part of the time that we live in, I guess.
And exactly with the galleries, I think it's most evident in the resumes of most artists, which has solo shows and group shows.
Yeah.
So what you do on your own is more important than what you do with other people. And I think that's a perfect example of the kind of structure that we're in. Because obviously, and I think the work we're doing, the work you do with other people tends to be more important, and it becomes more, I don't know, like where do you fall in, like, the, you know, what does that mean, solo show, group show? I think I'm just kind of fascinated by that whole distinction and that idea of in some ways, the experience of cultural work alone, especially in fine art, I think is privileged in that way. And what happens when you step outside, not only that structure, but also this physical space, and you're on the street of the city doing things, and your identity gets lost in it, I think.
But then you get a new one.
Yeah.
I guess. Can I ask?
Of course.
Yeah. What happened with the Olympic Garden? You should tell them about that. It's just great.
Well, I did a... The Olympic Garden, well, when I was in London doing the garden there, they had this thing called Debate London, where they, for 3 nights, invited groups of people to present ideas in the Turbine Hall, and one night was the future of London. So everyone had to get up there and give 3 minutes of a thought about what the future of London would be. And I usually speak extemporaneously. I hate writing things down, but I actually had to write something down for 3 minutes because there's no way I could make it up in 3 minutes. So, and I need a proposal, and you know, there's John Bird, who's this crazy politician there, and there's Zaha Hadid, and I had to,
wow,
2,000 people or whatever. So I had to have a thought about what the future of London could be for someone who had spent a total of 2 weeks there, and you know, it was ridiculous. So basically my proposal was that for the Olympic Games 2012, there would be a new Olympic event called Olympic Gardening, and the goal would be to grow all of the food for all of the Olympic visitors within the city limits of London, which would, I forget how many thousands of acres it would be, but I did all the math and figured out the food miles from the visiting countries and where all this would be grown, and then we would have the Olympic farmers, which would go on to be the great celebrities that would be gossiped about and be on the covers of all the tabloids, and they would get all of the big endorsements, and there would be a huge shift with the 2012 Olympics towards like superstar celebrity urban farmers, and there'd be these fabulous Olympic gardening uniforms that people would want to wear. Maybe they'd be really tight, and you'd have garden trolleys going through town delivering food directly from the gardens to wherever people are eating. And basically all these Olympic resources would go towards not Millennium Domes, but towards a whole new kind of urban landscape that would be then inherited by the next generation. Thank you. So that's reprinted in the Edible Estates book, but I'm so glad you enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah.
It was cute. I'll have to say, when I read that, the daughter of Rowan Moore, I believe is his name, who is the director of the Architecture Foundation, was in the audience. And during my talk, she did a sketch of the Olympic gardening uniform. She's 7, I think, or something. So Rowan gave that to me after, and I scanned it and put it on the website where I have it printed so you can see what a potential gardening uniform would look like. But that's, to me, that's a huge part of the project, is like, what am I going to wear? That's awesome. So the fact that she had that already, she was already thinking, I was really impressed about that.
That's okay.
Yeah.
What's your relationship to the notion of community activism? Or do you see yourselves following in the legacy of muralists working to inform the public?
Well, look, I think muralism was super important, right? And in process of a lot of things and thinking, and it has its own weight in time, right? But and then, for example, where I come from, there is a big tradition about protest art, right? And but you come to a point that you have to hold these things, no? Because it's like going to the doctor, right, and saying, well, you know, I feel so bad, man. And he's saying, yeah, you should take this thing. And then next time, you don't take nothing, and you go back, and you're worse, you know? And protest art is that. It's wonderful, and there are diagnostics, and diagnostics are very important for me, but you have to go from protest to proposals, right? So then this idea of education that I think is very important in the process of our work. But like for example, you were in architectural school, when they tell you that something is utopic, it just means that it's not going to be done never,
right? It's a way to dismiss it, isn't it?
Right, and it's a bad adjective. And it means, and actually to be something utopic is actually something that is the ideal of something, right? Or when it's something is educational, right? It means that you are, the bad adjective is that it's something very, I don't know, naive and straightforward. And it should be something that is part of a process of education that enhances a project, right? And allows you to read it in another way. That way, for example, the aesthetical value of these projects, in my perspective, one of the most important ones, and they look good, and they taste good, right? But then there is this idea and that notion of dialogue activation, right? And then dialogues that activate not only all the dialogues, but action that activate new projects and new dialogues, right? And you start to build a chain, right? So it's more along those lines. But thank you, Will, the muralists are very big.
Well, I think also part of, I think it's interesting the way we throw around this idea of utopia so easily. And to me, utopia means, it implies starting over in a way. And every building by every great architect of the 20th century on some level, I think, is utopian because it's about starting over. We talk a lot about responding to what's there, but usually it's about, look how great this thing is that I'm making. And it's a version of starting over. And I think with all of my work, I'm picking up the pieces at the bottom, finding out ways to repurpose what we've already have and finding out what resources exist that can be redirected in some way. And I think I'm attracted to work that is simultaneously quite serious and grave and responsive to a particular problem, but it's also ridiculous and hilarious and impossible and absurd. And depending on the person looking at it, and there's very earnest environmentalists who look at my work and they just are all about problem solving, let's save the world, and I'm so glad you're on board with us saving the world. I'm like, okay, that's cool. But it makes me a little uncomfortable. And then at the same time, there's always an aspect of impossibility to the work. Or it's that like looking at one lawn that's gone and people are growing food and you're simultaneously like, awesome, what if we all did that? And then you have this, because that's the point of the project, and then you have this thought in your head like, what if we did all do that? Like, oh, the whole world would change overnight. And then the simultaneous thought is, it's never going to happen. It's exactly. Impossible. And I love that moment in your head where you capture both at the same time. And to me, that's what the project is. It's about that like penetrating moment into like current human condition that's about like impossible hope and the realization of total impossibility, you know, at the same time. And for me, it's all about that. And it's not about like telling people you're idiots if you don't do this and we all have to do it, or saying this is just a poetic thing and it's all about being pretty or something.
I know, and it has a certain, and it has a complete logic to that particular place and stuff and a response to it. It's, yeah, I agree.
So Fritz, with your almost implementing guerrilla-like tactics in targeting neighborhoods that have like the strictest land use laws where you think you might wind up in jail, do you see things evolving in a more farcical way as you interact with these people that have the strictest laws?
Well, it's actually not guerrilla at all. It's totally sanctioned, and that's the whole point. Like, I'm working on private property with the owners who are totally on board. So I never do anything. I never plant on that strip between the sidewalk and the street. Everything's legal. It's all private property. No complexities in terms of working. I mean, I've done these apartment complexes and larger like things, I suppose. But, you know, no, the whole point is doing projects that anyone can do by themselves over a weekend on private property so that it isn't guerrilla in that way. It's actually, I mean, I talked about wanting to do someplace that it's legal, but it would only raise issues of private property and what are we able to do in our private property. If you can't grow food in front of your house, like, what does that mean? Yeah. So
the guy says, look, he was in Martha Stewart.
Well, and it's all about, like, I've really become fascinated with going to the very heart of contemporary culture and for when I'm there for people not to know where it came from or when the project's there. So I love the fact that when the projects are written about, they don't have to mess with the idea that it was commissioned by an art museum. It's just there. And as soon as you attach the word art to it, then people bring all this baggage that complicates it in unnecessary ways. So, yeah.
How are we doing on time, Agnes?
Well,
Yeah. Does anyone in the audience have any questions for Fritz or Raoul?
And I have a microphone here, so just raise your hand.
Hi. Thanks for speaking, both of you. I have a question for both. I was curious, your ideas are so large and conceptual in the beginning, it seems like, and then you both have a really interesting and different tactic for making the project actually happen on the practical levels. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you come up with a large overarching vision for something in an idealistic way and then decide how to make things happen in a real setting.
I like that commonality about both of our work, which I don't think I thought about before, but I think it's true. Like, we're both ultimately getting down to very practical issues on the ground, making things. So I don't know. I guess I feel like maybe my work starts with moments that I find around me that seemed loaded or charged in some way, that obviously have bigger universal implications, but they're manifested in really small ways, like a compost pile or front lawn or something. And so if you start from that little moment, you know whatever you do there, it's going to have radiate in ways that you can't even predict.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's the way cities should be planned. Really, like going from micro planning to macro planning. I mean, for example, if you think about cities that 70% of them are built not by architects or planning, but by the necessity of the people. If you go about it by the necessity of one people, and then you start to wonder how these people make the decisions, and then you work on that realm. And then there are things that just make sense. Like I don't know, for example, the mangrove thing. The mangrove that I show you over there with the transplanting of the mangrove doing this thing, if that doesn't happen, the next degree or point or whatever hurricane that hit this spot, there will be over 28 neighborhoods and more than 100,000 persons, not only without a home. No, it will be a real, real disaster, right? But then there are certain things that happen in those things that are, like I said, super valid territories to work on. Yeah.
To both of you, do you check in on previous projects?
I have to. Because, for example, the projects, in my case, become systems, right? And systems that continue to evolve by themselves. And they have they sustain themselves, right? And I have to go back in order for them not to fall sometimes, but sometimes just to yeah, right? And there are sometimes like three or four going at it at the same time that are being developed, and then they're the only one. That way, this thing of being a collective effort just makes sense.
Yeah.
And I go to great lengths to make sure I'm doing the gardens in places where they're going to be around for a while, and I'm in touch with all of them, and they're still going. But I mostly try to disappear once they're planted, because then it only becomes clear that it's their garden, not mine. Otherwise, I don't want to feel like they're taking care of my garden. It's obviously theirs. So I'm just in touch enough to be able to get what information I need. There's photographers visiting every week the first season, and I get stories from them. But I like to be in touch, but in limited strategic ways. So.
Anyone else in the audience for more questions?
All right.
So Fritz, your approach to urban versus suburban environments, what do you see as some of the fundamental differences?
I don't know, that's interesting because it's so different, at least just with the garden projects, to think of what the implications are in the middle of the city versus in the suburbs, I suppose. I guess with both the animal projects and the garden projects, I'm looking at possibilities for weaving in other sorts of activity into places that we've already claimed. So in general, I guess I'm more interested in asking questions about what we've claimed, and I think, in a way, the simple division of suburban from urban is no longer helpful for us, because those, I feel like that's become blurred, and once we start to prescribe, I feel like a lot of problems are we have today are one just of words and semantics and labels that public and private space, for example, it's something we're very comfortable legally distinguishing between them, and yet we understand experientially it's so much more complicated than that, than to divide them so clearly is no longer helpful. And I think probably the same is true of urban and suburban, because they bring too many preconceptions with them. And I guess, I don't know. Does that make sense? I don't know, what do you think? I mean, I think I grew up in what we would call the suburbs, you know, very much suburban environment in Minneapolis. So I'm very familiar with what a life in that kind of situation is. And I moved to New York. My God, I started dreaming of moving to New York when I was like, you know, whatever, 14, couldn't wait. So to me, there's something really oppressive about that kind of environment. And I gave my parents hell for so long about living there and then going back there. And then they moved into the middle of the city and I moved to LA, like on top of a hill driving everywhere. So they kind of think it's hilarious that I'm in the situation that I'm in living in now, which is, you know, you could call suburban in some levels. So I don't know. But I wanted to move to LA because I wanted to live in the middle of all of that. I wanted to live in the middle of what most people are living in, and I wanted to understand it, and I wanted to be in a place where all those complexities were happening and all that conflict was happening in a way that it doesn't happen in the city, like a completely human-dominated landscape like Manhattan. I think there's more charged...
Actually, if you put, you know, because Tijuana is 2 hours from L.A., and if you take San Diego out and you put Tijuana and L.A. together, it makes sense.
Yeah.
If you put San Diego in the middle, it's just contrast, yeah. Right? Because there is certain thing about it. For example, in the context of Tijuana, there is this thing. I mean, it's so hard to read, and you have to, even the census gets it wrong. Right, because you live in between legalities, illegalities, movement, velocity. It's a thing that happens in which, I don't know, there is certain aesthetic value, not in the very common, you know, institutional way, but in terms of those exchanges, that it makes it very exciting. And it confronts you to certain reality that becomes a laboratory. Not only to make work about it, but actually just the condition, even the border issue. Right? It's not only about politics, no, or sociopolitical border. It's a border of language. It's a border of economics, no? I earn in pesos and I'm paying dollars. People expect me to speak in English, right? And even the guys who are bilingual. And then, for example, I want to send something to my mother in Sinaloa. I have to export it to my own country. And then I have to export things from the United States. You know, and it's this certain condition that, just like you, when you were talking about this point, that you start over, no? This utopian idea, well, you start over. Well, it's the same thing. These limits become these liminal points to start things over, right? It's a pretext for engagement.
So did you, in your collaboration in Bolzano, another kind of border town where you're yeah. German and Italian, did you have any epiphanies? Did you have any... shocks to your system?
A bunch of them. In every context has a border. Every context has a limit. And like I said, those limits are possibilities. In the case of Bolzano, well, Bolzano is a place in Italy, for the guys who don't know. I mean, it's more... after the First World War, the Italians got this piece of territory that was, I think, more from the Austro-Hungarian Empire or something like that. And it's in between, you know, this place. But, for example, these people are 69% of German heritage or only mostly speak German. Then just 27% are from super Italian heritage. The rest are 4% of the Ladinos, who are the natural people from there, and the extra communitarian that they think it's too much, right? And they tell you just like that, yeah, it's too much people. And they make policies for that not to happen, right? They do this. I mean, for example, you cannot, right, if you put a new business, for example, and you have these parameters of percentages, right, in your business, they help you with the taxes and stuff or with stuff. And they pay less taxes than the rest of Italy, right? Mm-hmm. So they don't go independent or something, right? And so, well, every territory said there is some shock, if you will.
Fritz, in your...
I think there's a question there.
Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to know, you were talking about animals, and I saw in your presentation, like, with kind of including animals, how much does that play into the work as opposed to just planting gardens and this kind of thing? And is that something that is much harder to do when you're looking into suburbs and this kind of deal? And then also, do you feel like you can, like in a big city like New York, it seems like it would take a lot of money to have something like that because most people don't have yards. So you kind of need to be like wealthy and live up in the buildings and...
To have a garden like that?
Yeah, kind of like that. Well, like in New York Magazine, I don't know if you saw, it was like those people who had...
Urban homesteaders?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the animal projects, that's a very particular series of projects that happens in cities that, you know, there were 7 editions last year and the couple of others coming up, but it's a particular project focused on a very particular issue of making homes for animals, and I haven't directly worked with any animals. I don't deal with animals. I don't come in contact with them. I don't see them. I make stuff for them. They might come or they might not. We do dances. We do workshops. We run around. There's like reading library, whatever. It's like everything but animals. And then for the garden projects, all these projects grow out of what's possible. Well, I only do projects that are prototypical. So they only happen in ways that, in particular situations that are common globally, so that anyone could imagine doing the same thing. And I always do them with very limited means. My ideal budget when I'm putting together a budget for one of these gardens is that in the whole budget for the museum or the institution, the garden is free because it's volunteer labor and donated materials. And all the budget goes to all the fees for all the collaborators, like the videographer, the graphic designer, the writer, the me, travel, whatever. So like, the budget is all for people, and the physical material of what would usually be privileged in an art project is free.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is there funding already built into this then? So when you go to the people's doors, not only do you need someone to participate, but how much money do they have to put forward to say yes?
The family? No, that's free. The family doesn't pay anything. The project of a museum or art institution will contact me and say, oh, we'd like to invite you to do a project at our place. What would you like to do? And I'm like, well, I want to make a garden. And then there's a budget. So the budget that would usually goes towards something at the museum then happens at this people's front yard. And then, well, not really because the garden might be free, but then whatever's this is the way the story that's then told in the gallery, out in the world or whatever, that is the produced part of the project that has the budget. But no, the garden's free, and that's the whole point. There is no budget. So ideally.
More people don't want a free garden in their front yard?
It is a huge, huge commitment to publicly garden in front of your house forever. Yeah. You know, because they're making a commitment to do this as long as they're there. And these kind of gardens are a lot of work, and you have to know what you're doing. So it's not anyone. These are like people that have hopefully been gardening there for a while that know what they're doing, that, you know, it's a huge... huge deal, and sometimes particularly the family in Lakewood, they were freaked out at first. Coming out your door that first morning after we planted and freaked out the neighbors and, you know, going out there to garden at 8 in the morning while everyone's watching, and as soon as things start to look not so good, everyone knows about it, and it's a very public activity, and not just the neighbors are watching, but everyone in town because, you know, it was on Fox News or whatever. You know, so people start to drive by and see what's going on. So it's a huge commitment. It's not financial, but they're also, you know, they're eating for free and, you know, they're producing way more than they can eat and they're giving it away.
Wonderful. It's a pretty good place to leave it. But before we wrap up, do either of you have any concluding thoughts to share with the audience?
Well, to thank you guys and to tell Fritz that I can't wait to talk to him more because, you know, this ever-growing project like the one in the Botanical Garden, I mean, I'm going to get... really want to talk to him about things. And if you guys want to know why Mexican people will still be fat even if we had McDonald's, like, we'll be glad to tell you why.
That's such a pleasure, and I think it was an interesting... I was really curious to see my work up against yours as contrast just from where we're from, but also, we should work together. We could grow some things to make some, like, some Toro Lab food out of or something.
Geez, I'm going to be planting gardens in Culiacan for 30
okay,
years,
let's
man.
Do it.
Well, Pete.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. And thanks to the AV people for pulling this off so flawlessly. I really appreciate your help. And have a great evening.